4.6 billion.
The Earth forms.
Cambrian.
542 million.
Complex life explodes.
Permian Triassic.
251 million.
90% of species die.
Cretaceous Tertiary.
65 million.
Meteor kills the dinosaurs.
55 million.
Primates appear.
2.3 million.
Pleistocene.
200,000.
Humans appear.
20,000.
Agricultural
250.
Revolution. Industrial Revolution.
60.
Great Acceleration.
The Anthropocene.
Welcome to Generation Anthropocene, the program where we explore what it means to be living in the new geologic age. I'm your host, Mike Osborne, and today we'll be featuring an interview with human ecologist Bill Durham. Stay with us.
Hi, my name is Jenny Rempel, and I'm here today with Bill Durham, who is a senior fellow at the Woods Institute. He's the Bing Professor in Human Biology, and he's also in the Anthropology Department here at Stanford. Thank you for coming in, Bill.
I'm happy to be here.
So I was wondering if you could just start off by telling us a little bit about your research. What does it mean to be a human ecologist?
I think of human ecology as the intersection of the natural and social sciences that focus on, you know, human communities there and their use of resources and environment and the way the communities influence the environment and the environment influences the communities. So it's a feedback loop between human populations and environments. It consists on the one hand of human influences on environment, sometimes for the better and often for the worse. And it consists of environmental influence on human communities, the way that environments give us shape communities, give feedback, intrinsic rewards, you could say, for certain kinds of activity and intrinsic punishments for others, and thereby shape the nature of human society. So it's the interactive dynamics between human communities and their environments.
And did you jump right into this? Or I think you sort of started in basic ecology and evolution, if I'm not mistaken.
Years ago, I was a Stanford undergraduate. And I was heavily influenced at that time, yes, by courses that I was taking in the biological sciences at Stanford. There was no human biology then, although students in general were hankering for a kind of a relevance about our education. This was back in the days of the Vietnam War and back in the days of the first Earth Day. And what I remember is being very affected by both of those things, by the total effect, social and environmental, of the war in Vietnam, and then also by the coming attention to environmental issues that came with Earth Day. So we did. We had our little stand out in White Plaza on Earth Day, and we taught people effectively through a little hands-on operation about the negative effects of eutrophication and phosphate-containing detergents. At the time, you know, some of the well-known detergents like Tide were rich in phosphates, and this was clogging up the waters. And so what we did was did a little demonstration showing that just a little extra scrubbing and just basic some basic soaps were better than or as good as phosphate-containing detergents. And I was very affected by, you know, all of the environmental attention at the time and decided that the course of studies that I wanted for myself would combine an interest in the social, the human, and the environmental, the ecological. So I took a hybrid of courses and then went to the University of Michigan to pursue more advanced training and went to ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan, but told them explicitly I wanted to work on human issues. And
Did they take that very well, or were you kind of pushing the envelope?
I was definitely pushing the envelope. We had nothing like a Woods Institute then. We had only traditional departments. And I found a core of faculty who were very supportive, of this idea that the study of human-environmental interactions could be done in a scientific manner that would integrate the natural and social sciences, that would use the principles of both and bring them together, but also wary of the limitations, that is to say, of over-biologicizing social phenomena, or the reverse of drawing loose analogies in the social realm to things that, you know, that didn't have a biological counterpart. And in general, what I found at Michigan was a very supportive faculty who said, yeah, by all means, go to it. How can we help? And that was really a wonderful message to have received. So I went on to, you know, do a dissertation project on the causes of scarcity in Central America and how scarcity had been both environmentally and socially generated, and then also the effects of that scarcity, how it shaped communities and shaped histories of peoples and countries, even in Central America.
And since then, you've come back to Stanford, and you're even a MacArthur Prize recipient for some of your work.
Well, it's good luck.
Would you tell us a little bit more about what you're focusing on these days? Because I know you've shifted quite a bit towards ecotourism, infectious disease. Yeah, just give us some sense of what you're working on at the moment.
Well, I think all both of the things you mentioned and then even one more. I would say I actually have sort of three main areas of interest today. Let me start with the most recent and work backwards. Together with other colleagues at Stanford, most notably Professor Rodolfo Dirzo, I think, who's also in your series. I'm not sure, but together we're co-directors at Stanford of an international initiative in Costa Rica. We're working to help Costa Rican academics, government officials, local leaders, and so on to design a sustainability plan for a small region of Costa Rica called the Osa Peninsula. It's the smaller of the two big peninsulas on the Pacific side of the country. I guess basically we say it's sort of the size of Maryland. It's a pretty small area, but it has within it a lot of the issues, a lot of the problems and a lot of the potentials of sustainability efforts more generally. So we're hopeful that working with Costa Ricans and giving them the best of our advice and methods and so on, that we can help build a sustainability plan for this region. It's especially exciting because the region's a microcosm. It has some rich cultural diversity, and it's considered the jewel of biodiversity of Costa Rica. It's still a beautiful tropical rainforest habitat generally. There's some diversity of ecosystems there, but it's largely lowland tropical rainforest. And it has all the problems of expanding commercial agriculture, African oil palm, expansion of commercial rice, cattle, and so on. So finding a path towards sustainability in this little microcosm, I think, could be useful more generally, more broadly.
That is really wonderful. But I want to just draw back a little bit and ask you what you see as sort of the potential for these experiential learning opportunities where you have a diverse age group who are really interacting with the subjects they're studying. Mm-hmm. Does that have the power to really foster the type of environmental ethic we're looking for? You spoke a bit about Earth Day and how transformative that's been for you, but do you think this experiential education can drive the changes our society needs going forward?
Well, it could never be the sole motor of change, but I think it can really make a contribution. One of the reasons we so often go to Galapagos on that is because I feel as though two things are operating simultaneously in our society. As you know, a majority of North Americans do not accept an evolutionary history to life. And at the same time, I think a majority of North Americans are concerned about, you know, what to make of environmental change, how important is it, how important is it is conservation, what's the deal with climate change, and so on. I actually see these two questions as related, that if we did a better job of teaching evolution and explaining to people carefully, starting at the earliest levels, what evolution says and what it doesn't say, and conveying to people the enormous importance of the connectedness of all life, right? When you go to Galapagos, one of the things you feel, because organisms there have no fear, because you can move right up to a blue-footed booby or a marine iguana within inches. You must not reach out and touch organisms, but we've had Galapagos sea lions crawl into our laps as we're standing on the beach. If the wildlife crawls into your lap, you can't stop it because you'd have to reach out and touch them. So,
and I remember that was one of the most amazing experiences.
Incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. Absurd biodiversity and wildlife and plant life. Just right, you could, if you wanted, reach out and touch it, but obviously we didn't. But it is such a unique opportunity to understand how connected life is, just as you were saying.
Well, this whole connectedness then comes out of that experience of visiting Galapagos and could, I think, come out of a better teaching of evolution. And then when it, just look how different your perspective is on conservation when you say, wow, I'm related to all living things. There's unbroken web of life connecting me to every other living thing. It no longer is a challenge to explain why conservation. Conservation is part of the appreciation of this great experiment in life of which each one of us is a part. So what I would say is that conservation and evolution are really two sides of the same thing, and that if we can do a better job teaching evolution through experiential means, through whatever means we can do a better job of teaching evolution, I think we'll see a lot more people changing their environmental behaviors, changing the way we relate to consumption and the generation of solid and liquid waste and so on and so on. No longer is it a challenge to build a case for conservation, because that conservation, that rationale, the reasoning for that will be clear in the connectedness of life. If we can improve the teaching of evolution, I think conservation will be greatly enhanced almost automatically and logically. That's just a hypothesis.
I think I would definitely agree. I know when I think about sort of just evolution and even just picture, you know, the tree of life in my head, so to speak, it's impossible not to be motivated to engage in sort of environmental activism on campus and beyond. And for me, there's not one particular moment when I realized this connectedness and how important that is in informing my own work as an activist and researcher. But I was wondering if there was a moment for you when you kind of realized, wow, I'm related to some grass over there, or maybe it was this blue-footed booby in Galapagos. Or is there a moment, or has it always been there?
It hasn't always been there, but I think the process of discovery was really fun for me. As a child, I was a very bad boy one day and ran over some rocks with a lawnmower. And one of the rocks I hit turned out to be a fossil-containing rock. This is in northern Ohio. Well, northern Ohio is just a wonderful place for fossil collecting. My parents came running out and were quite upset. This was a rotary mower, and I was a small boy, and they were worried that I was going to hurt myself hitting rocks like this and being careless.
Understandably, yeah.
Well, what was interesting is that I tried to deflect their attention away from my misbehavior and onto this wonderful fossil that I'd hit.
That is so cool.
So I picked it up, and I tried to identify what it was, and I found very intriguing that my own backyard could contain something fossil-bearing. And went to the local library, and, you know, nobody knew much about fossils and so on. Anyway, was able to track it down and went on to just be terrifically interested. This was my little window into a deeper past of life. I had no idea where this was taking me. I just had hit this fossil with my lawnmower. And then I realized that northern Ohio was a relatively rich area for collecting certain kinds of fossils, trilobites, brachiopods, some crinoid stems and other things. And anyway, make a long story short, I began to collect fossils and then in northern Ohio, and then I would trade as my family traveled the country on family holidays and vacations. I'd fill shoeboxes with these little trilobites and brachiopods that I would collect, and we would go places and I would trade them. And, you know, people would trade me for dinosaur bone and mammoth teeth and all kinds of things. And my imagination would just go crazy. And one day, I'll never forget, I was 10 years old. And my mom said to me, she said, you know, there's a new thing in town, in the next town over. She was herself pursuing her master's degree in psychology at the time, at Baldwin Wallace College. She was interested in the child psychology of learning, and I guess I was one of her favorite test subjects or something. Anyway, she said, I'd like you to go with me to Baldwin Wallace College tonight. I want to take you to this new thing. There's a new bookstore. Turns out there was a paperback bookstore. My family was a very modest means living in rural Ohio, and, you know, I didn't have a whole lot of books when I was growing up. We used the library a lot. Well, she took me to this paperback bookstore, and she went over and picked up this book and bought it for me. And I thought, wow, how exciting to have this book. And she said, now, you're not going to understand this for a while. I want you to have this book. You're not going to understand it. And I said, well, what is it? What is it about? And it was, of course, Charles Darwin on the Origin of Species. I still have the book. She said, someday this is going to open doors for you and help you understand all these things that you're collecting and all the joy that you find in your fossils. This is one of the leading thinkers in helping us understand what fossils are all about. So I still have that book, and of course, it's become very important to me.
Wow, that's an amazing story, Bill.
So,
that's such a great
story. So from fossils
childhood.
In the backyard to Charles Darwin, that's how
you started to realize the connectedness and get interested in this. So I cut you off at the very beginning of this interview. You were telling us sort of about these three focal areas for your current research, because I'm pretty sure you're not still focusing on collecting fossils. You may do this in your spare time. I'm not sure.
I do have some fossils, and I love to collect fossils. I always will.
But I'd love to hear, to return to that and hear sort of what you would consider the other two main areas you're doing research in now.
Well, my love of evolution obviously led me to take many trips to Galapagos and to begin some studies there, which were alarming to me of the impact of human population in Galapagos. Most people don't realize that the Galapagos has a human settlement, well over 30,000 people permanently resident in Galapagos. We think of it as Darwin's Enchanted Isles that you might see them today, much like Darwin saw them.
And I know I didn't realize that, but there are these vibrant communities that are just living and existing there.
Yeah. With all of their, strengths and weaknesses, with all their foibles. And so many of the plants and animals that we've introduced to Galapagos come from that human settlement and come from the tourism that has attracted that human settlement. So after working and studying and thinking about evolution in Galapagos for a long time, I felt like it would be nice to return, and also tropical forest areas where I've worked a lot of my career as well, in the Amazon and Central America. So I began to be interested. The tourism that I was doing with Stanford, leading tours and so on, and I would see lots of other groups, and I began to be interested in this phenomenon of environmentally sensible travel or ecotourism, and agreed back in the International Year of Ecotourism, I believe it was 2002, to co-host a conference on the topic, because I thought it was interesting in a way that maybe I could help return some benefit to the places like the Amazon and Galapagos that I had studied and benefited, to return to Costa Rica, to return to the Amazon, return to Galapagos, some of the things that I had learned and built my career from. Well, the conference was very interesting, very successful, and introduced me to a whole number of people who were studying ecotourism and its impact. And I hadn't realized that tourism is the largest legal business in the world, and that ecotourism is the...
Wow, I didn't know that either.
Yeah, it's amazing. And ecotourism was the most rapidly growing part of the largest business in the world. And I began to think, if you could have an influence on the largest business in the world, roughly 10% of the labor force in the world is employed in tourism-related activity, that maybe you could use that and this idea of experiential learning and put the two together and really help shape a more sustainable future, a future that would have more benefits for local communities, even as they invested and conserved their local environments for the learning potential and the experiential potential that they had. And so I sort of thought this idea of ecotourism could be one way that I could help return some of the benefit I'd received over the years myself. So together with Dr. Martha Honey of Washington, D.C., we started a little center on was then called Ecotourism and Sustainable Development. We now call it the Center for Responsible Travel. And we've been merrily conducting a group of studies to show the potential, both the problems and the potential, I would say, of environmentally sensitive travel, travel to natural areas that helps to conserve environments and helps to improve the livelihood, the well-being of local populations. It's an interesting enterprise. It's not always successful. There's a lot of what we call greenwashing out there, but it's been interesting and important to me to feel as though we might help shape that industry toward community beneficial and environmentally beneficial ends.
And some people, I would say that ecotourism has only really taken off as a concept, an active practice in our society in the past few decades. And I'm sure you know the history more than I do, but some people balk at the idea. There seems to be some type of contradiction between even the two parts of the word eco and tourism. And I'd say maybe they rarely, if ever, even went together before, as I was saying a few decades ago. So what really led to this modern wave of ecotourism? And do you see a contradiction there yourself?
I was one of those people 20 years ago. You know, I thought all tourism was damaging. And I would say, indeed, most of it is today. But we like to distinguish mass tourism from, you know, this sort of careful, thoughtful tourism that ecotourism aspires to be. One of the problems that we have in the whole field is that is the problem of standards and definitions, that you need a system of measurements and tools to assure that some kinds of tourism are different from others and that ecotourism lives up to some fundamental standards like returning benefits to communities and helping to conserve the environment rather than to destroy it. So one of the issues that we've had to deal with is the whole question of certification. How do you certify that things really are on the up and up and really are at a high level? And it's interesting because I was a total skeptic. 20 years ago, I just thought tourism was trashing the planet. It was ruining Galapagos. It was ruining the Amazon. And I've come full circle now to think that there is a potential. Now, it's not intrinsic. It's not intrinsic in tourism. Tourism uses fossil fuels to get to places, so it's already starting with a carbon deficit. The question is, can you – obviously, we're a very curious primate. Obviously, we want to learn. We love to travel. Experiential learning is just a good example of all of that. Can we use those impulses, the very basic – sort of primate heritage, and can we shape it in a way that can be a force for good in the world? It's not intrinsic. It's not going to always happen. It's not even going to happen a lot unless we do it thoughtfully and with some application of standard. And gosh, you know, if the world's largest industry can be changed just a little, think how much better the whole planet will be.
And then I guess I just have one last big question, which is where you'd place the boundary for the beginning of the Anthropocene.
Well, I know that's a fascinating question for people. And some people would say, gosh, it's the invention of agriculture. And other people would say, no, it's the Industrial Revolution. You know what I'd like to suggest? That this is really wacky and it probably won't go any place after this conversation. But maybe the right time to put it is the time at which we understand our place in the web of life. So maybe it was Darwin who started it. Because before Darwin, it wasn't possible. We didn't understand that human beings are a part of the tree of life, that all of life is related. And now that we understand that, it seems to me the challenge is upon us to realize our place in this greater picture of life and to realize the responsibility and the responsibility and the privilege that we have allow and encourage that biodiversity to prosper. Without seeing the connectedness of life, I don't think we really had a way to understand and appreciate and really marvel at how wonderful the rest of biodiversity is. You could make arguments for protecting biodiversity, but to realize that all of life is connected. So maybe I would say a novel way to think of the Anthropocene is to as beginning with this insight that all of life is connected, that human beings did not have a supernatural origin, that we're, you know, a branch on the tip of the tree of life, and to begin to think about that, reflect on that, and use that to shape our relations with the environment and with the rest of life. And gosh, we're just beginning, huh? If not even 50% of North Americans accept an evolutionary history to life, we have a long way to go. But I think that's the exciting thing about the Anthropocene is that it can On the one hand, it could be very damaging. On the other hand, we can also, there is a possibility that we can learn how to steward this planet and to find ways of coexisting in the future. I know that sounds optimistic. There's a lot of work to be done. But I personally think that without evolution being one of the key ingredients, there's no hope.
Wow. Well, Bill, I want to say thank you for your efforts to help me better understand the connectedness of life and for your work with so many countless others to really help us understand how humans fit into this larger, the larger planetary ecosystem we have. But thanks again for coming in and for sharing your insights.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I hope your appreciation of the connectedness of life will continue to prosper and grow.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Generation Anthropocene. We want to thank all of the students and subjects who contributed to this project. And you can find the full-length interviews at our website, stanford.edu/group/Anthropocene. Thanks to Maserati for letting us use their song Monoliths. A very special thanks to co-producer Tom Hayden for feedback, guidance, and inspiration. Thanks also to Julie Kennedy in the Earth Systems Program. And thanks to KZSU Studios Stanford, where all of our interviews were recorded. History is accelerating, and you're a part of it too. Where would you draw the line?